current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. It's our Tuesday edition of the program. Some number of our current state listeners are without power here today as we speak to you. Scott Davis of the Lansing State Journal says crews, utility crews, are working to restore power to nearly 1,500 customers in mid-Michigan following a lightning storm that swept through the region last night. The outage map for the Lansing Board of Water and Light, which provides service for the Lansing area, showed no outages this morning, but DTE and consumers are both dealing with them, a number of them in Clinton County. Later on in the program here today, we talk with the author of an interesting book, The Arsenal of Democracy. This is captures in photographs the transition of Detroit's automotive economy into a war footing, if you will, in the late 1930s and 1940s. Peter Worf joins us for that segment coming up. We'll also get we'll also have a more explanation here of the Hobby Lobby ruling yesterday by the Supreme Court from Devin Schindler of Cooley Law School. At the top of our program, we still have miles to go to rebuild Michigan after years of neglect. That sentence reflects the findings of a new report from the Michigan Economic Center at the Prima Civitas Foundation. The Michigan Dream at Risk report explores the societal costs of recent declines in investment in education, infrastructure, our cities, and the environment. Here's a segment from a video presentation that accompanies the report.
Funds to protect our natural resources have diminished significantly.
There is this movement to want to cut taxes.
Spending on roads and bridges were reduced.
The sewer infrastructure in our major cities is in desperate need of repair.
Our roads are crumbling.
There's been a disinvestment. K-12 ed, higher ed, many school districts have cut back on music and art and, you know, the kind of cultural things that are really important.
The Michigan Dream at Risk report also says there is significant public support for increased investment. So what does the report suggest regarding the Michigan comeback touted by Governor Rick Snyder and his supporters? Well, to answer that and up to 1,000 or so other questions, we welcome back John Austin of the Michigan Economic Center. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mark.
We'll also point out John is president of the State Board of Education and a non-resident senior fellow with the Brookings Institution. How did you compile your report?
Well, and I'm glad you played that video clip, and folks can go to the MichiganDream.org website and get the video, but also this really interactive set of stories and perspectives from real citizens and some of our experts, because stories tell more than the facts, which are also pretty sobering about our disinvestment and its effect on our incomes, and the imagery and the words that our citizens use about what they really care about. And that's where we started. We went out beginning a couple years ago and had focus groups and did survey work with citizens of Michigan and asked them, what do you care about this state? What is special about this state? And what really makes it go economically? And there was amazing convergence, whether you were up north or in Detroit, about the values Michigan citizens have and what they really view as special about the state and makes it go. And those were, you know, hard work being rewarded with opportunity, with great schools and great universities as a pathway to that opportunity. Having communities you can be proud of that are great places to raise a family, that aren't falling apart, where the roads are good and you have a pleasant environment to raise a family. And also this beautiful outdoors, this Great Lakes, we're going to all start enjoying it as we head up north this week. But that pure Michigan that we hold so dear, of having great places to escape with our family, clean water, Great Lakes, great park system, those are also defining features. And we ask people, okay, how are we doing? Are we taking good care of those things? And folks across the board said we're not living up to our pure Michigan ideal of what we really want to make the state be. And if anything, we're seeing continued trends of disinvestment, as that clip showed, in our road system, in our higher education and education system, and our great outdoors and taking good care of our clean water and our parks. Pure Michigan is not real if it's not made real by the continuing support for these things that Michigan citizens really care about.
There's a lot of pretty grim data in your report. Over the past 12 years, Michigan family income and buying power has fallen more than any other state in the nation. Over the past decade, Michigan communities lost over 4,000 police and firefighters due to budget cuts, and I could go on and on. Where did the data come from?
The data came from the very credible and good estimates that many of our analysts and economists and think tanks have put together. Most of the kind of the headline data over the last 10 years in terms of the real disinvestment trends come from the Center for Michigan, the nonpartisan, down-the-middle-of-the-road think tank that says, for example, real decline of 16% in our K-12 investment over the last 10 years, real declines of 29% in our higher ed support, which is why tuitions have doubled, and one of the great pathways to opportunity, almost free great universities like Michigan State and U of M are not almost free and are being priced out of reach. 6% decline in our support for clean water and conservation, and a 31% cut in our basic city services, whether it's fire, roads, and municipal services of police. That's a significant walk back from the things that we did together. We came together to build a great road system. We invented the car and the road system. We built one of the greatest marvels of great public education and affordable higher education as the path to opportunity. We created for working people parks and lakes that you could enjoy and that were clean. We've diminished all of that, and it's been it's noticed, and it's painful for Michigan citizens, and they don't like it, and they really would like their leaders to get some spine and take better care of these things that power Michigan and that make it a special state to live and work, so we don't keep losing our kids to other places, and that we can attract all the people in the world who want to live and work in a beautiful, glorious state with great education and great communities, and make it that be Michigan.
Where would the funding come from to make this reinvestment a reality?
Well, we've got to do more than we're just now beginning to do with the modest kind of increments of money as our auto economy has come back. We've got to be willing to raise some new money. The reason we are disinvesting so dramatically, that we've cut billions out of our support for higher education, roads, basic community services, is mainly because we've been on a tax-cutting theology for the last 10 or 12 years. If we went back to just the tax rates that we had under John Engler, just the tax rates on income and business income, we would have $8 billion more money that we could fix every pothole. We could make higher education affordable once again for our young people. We could clean up all our water. It's because we've basically diminished our level of effort as a state in the things we do together, which are roads, which are clean water, which are higher education. We used to spend 4% or more of whatever income we had as a state. And yes, the auto decline hurt us. But we used to spend 4% of whatever income we had in these public investments and that really create conditions for Michigan to thrive. We're down to 3% of our income. We've walked away from the things that we do together. Other states have found ways to raise billions for clean water, outdoors, and conservation, Minnesota. Billions for innovation in higher ed, Ohio.
Your report is in sharp contrast, I think, to Michigan as a comeback state under Governor Rick Snyder. Here is a sample of what millions of Michiganians are hearing and seeing in one Snyder for Governor TV ad.
Governor Rick Snyder cut job-killing taxes, and Michigan gained 220,000 private sector jobs. First in the nation in manufacturing jobs. Rick focused on veterans, made it easier for them to find jobs. We're number one in states that have recovered the most from the Great Recession. Education funding's up. Our $1.5 billion deficit is gone.
John Austin, do you quarrel with those claims? Are they wrong? Are they not enough? How do you respond to those claims?
Well, this challenge for Michigan started long before Governor Snyder, meaning we began to disinvest a decade or more ago. What Governor Snyder has done has been some good and probably a little more bad. When we cut business taxes or tax pensioners, which we could and should do to raise money, we didn't put that into roads and into higher education. We have begun a very modest baby steps, as I say, in terms of some additional higher ed and preschool funding. But we have not been successful, and the governor has been championing raising real new money to fix our roads. Other leaders, our legislators, are not yet willing to do what Michigan citizens would like to see done, which is raise some money, yes, raise some taxes to fix the roads and to make higher education affordable even more so. And the governor has been willing to advocate for some of this. He's also accommodated some of the tax cutting, which does not support economic growth. That is where I strongly disagree. The cutting of taxes, you have to have a decent business climate. We've got that.
Did any of the participants in your survey acknowledge the particular challenges that result from recovering from a very serious recession? Clearly, it had a serious impact on public revenue. Did that come up?
Michiganders are hard workers, and they know we've been through hard times. They also appreciate that what we suffered in terms of lost jobs was made even more severe of what we suffered from a walk away from support for great, almost free higher education, from commitment to infrastructure and roads. When you ask, and we did ask in this 1,000-person survey we did, what really matters to support job creation? 64% of Michigan citizens believe the most important thing state government can do for job creation is to, quote, provide quality education, good roads and transportation, good public services like safety, water, fire, parks, and libraries that create an environment which people want to live, work, and run a business. Only 29% believe the most important thing state government can do is, quote, cut taxes for individuals and business. That's what really creates jobs. And they are right. All the evidence of the states that are succeeding with growing incomes today and growing economic opportunity are not the low-tax states. They're the states that actually have strong and robust support for cities that people want to live in, for education, higher education, and research as a pathway to opportunity and new job creation, that invest more, not less, in their people and in their place and in their state. And that's what Michigan used to do. That's what made us great. That's what made pure Michigan real.
How do you respond to critics who might say that without some degree of cutting of at least temporary disinvestment, that we'd have serious deficits and a seriously unsustainable situation?
Well,
along the lines of the federal government.
Michigan cannot run a deficit. We have chosen purposefully, though, to diminish our coming together and investing money by cutting taxes over the years. As I said, we used to be bumping up against the self-imposed Headley limit of how much tax revenue we would raise as a state. We are now $8 billion below that limit. We've basically walked away from a willingness to invest, our leaders have, and that's why we're calling, and I hope people will go to the MichiganDream.org to share their interests, share their frustrations, share their name and contact information, because our leaders need to get some appreciation that the things that people want to do better by, they know our schools are hurting, they want higher education to be affordable, they want to fix the roads, and they're willing to pay for it. We need to let our leaders know, and that's what I think this theology, again, of diminished support for public investment has taken us the wrong way. It certainly has not worked. Family incomes have plummeted more than any other state in Michigan over the last dozen years. So clearly the strategy of cutting taxes is not a recipe for economic success. Over that time, we've cut support for all the things that make pure Michigan real, that people know powers our state. When you ask them, as we do, when you hear their voices in our video and in our interactive report, you will, I think, appreciate, because it's so clear what people love about the state, and they want it to be real, and it can be real. And Michigan Economic Development Corporation made a great video a couple years ago, a pure Michigan video. It was just violins playing, beautiful visuals from this state, and some words scrolling across the screen. You know, kids jumping out of the cottage into the water. The number one public university was heralded, University of Michigan, as the images from people learning and research. It also had, you know, open road, people driving on this beautiful state, kids looking in wonder at the DIA and the Henry Ford. You could stop that video at any moment and say, look, that beach may be closed from fecal matter because we haven't been cleaning our water. The number one public university is now twice as expensive as it needs to be and isn't affordable for most people because we've been cut funding. Those arts and cultural institutions have been eviscerated. We don't support them anymore. And watch out for that open road driving your car. I got potholes in it. So all of those things that we reach to and that we love about pure Michigan that really make our hearts sing have been diminished and degraded, and people don't like it, and we need to work together to send that message to our leaders.
John Austin is our guest of the Michigan Economic Center. John is also president of the State Board of Education. Isn't to get back to the Headley limit, though, which you point out is the amount of revenue that could be brought in is still well below the Headley limit, as you said.
Yeah, I agree. When we did Proposal A, property taxes were way too high, and we were bumping up against a tax rate that was probably getting frustratingly close to being overtaxing. We are not there anymore.
Isn't it true, though, that some number of the state's large cities in particular, I believe Lansing is one of them, is up against the Headley limit? So where you would stand to make more of that public revenue, the bigger cities are up against that?
The overall state and local tax burden has been fundamentally reduced, and to the point where we're really diminishing our support for things that people care about and that matter in terms of roads, higher education, and outdoors. We can creatively, I think if you ask the citizens, raise money. Our legislators in particular have not been willing to do that. Minnesota took to the ballot a proposal a couple years ago during the recession and said, let's raise $6 billion over 25 years for clean water, parks and conservation, and the arts, because those are so important for who we are in Minnesota, having beautiful lakes. Well, that's Michigan, too. People want Pure Michigan to be real. We could raise some money. Ohio put $2.8 billion into higher education, innovation, research, new business development. Twice the voters voted for it. Our legislators won't even vote to fix the roads and put $1.5 billion in that's desperately needed when everyone, business, conservative, liberals, Democrats, agree we need to make it happen. They still can't pull the trigger.
Your report indicates significant support for public investment. Here in an election year, does that portend change?
I hope so, and I think that's why we need to encourage this discussion about what do Michigan's people really value about this state. What do they care about? And we need to, people vote for things and people support things they're emotionally attached to. And we've got to help make it clear. And I think this video and this report really listen to Michigan citizens, and it's their voices and their perspective of what they care about, what we all care about. I mean, I've raised my kids and enjoyed Pure Michigan and this wonderful opportunity to send my daughter to a great public university, which isn't almost free anymore, but it's still a great place.
Several polls have suggested that an edge. If you think that your findings portend change, several polls so far have suggested an edge, slight in some cases, but larger in others, for Rick Snyder in the governor's race. How do you square the support that the governor enjoys with the rather grim assessments of your report?
This is not about whether it's Rick Snyder or Mark Schauer or any of our leaders. I think the citizens of Michigan want to see support for and advocacy for the investments, yes, in the things that actually grow our economy, that they know grow our economy, and that really speak to them about what's special about Michigan. They do want communities that aren't falling apart. I mean, that's how they understand the roads issue. It's not the fact that they might pay more because they hit, a pothole and their tire is broken. That's painful. But the real reason they want to fix the roads is because it's embarrassing. They don't want to live in communities that no one around the country would be proud of. And they would rather raise their kids and have a business. And that's when we ask them, what's matter? Why do you care about road funding? Because it's embarrassing. Who'd want to live in a community that's falling apart? So we need to translate and support left, right, Democrat, Republican, an agenda that is about building up the things that make Michigan go economically and that people care about, not continuing to diminish and degrade them as we have. It's not a recipe for economic success. I think the data proves that, but more Michigan citizens know that.
You are president of the State Board of Education here in Michigan. I'd be very interested in your response to any of the articles that appeared recently in the Detroit Free Press regarding Michigan's charter schools.
Yeah, I think the Free Press series clearly illustrates that we're suffering educationally and financially in terms of support for schools by having a rather chaotic, unregulated new school, including charter creation program, which, again, the State Board and many of us have been arguing to improve and change and to walk back. When we create new charter schools in an environment where we have already declining enrollments and we're having to encourage some schools to consolidate because of that, and we don't ensure that those new schools are delivering quality education, we have a double lose situation. Those new schools are being marketed, and as the series illustrates, they're often of mediocre or really bad education delivery. They don't deliver good outcomes. We have not had common sense limits on, if we're going to open new charters, let's make sure they deliver quality education and not let bad operators we know don't educate kids open more schools. Those kids lose. They get a diminished education. Meanwhile, our traditional public schools with fewer students, fewer dollars, fewer teachers and ability to deliver quality education, we have a lose-lose in terms of our education outcomes, and we're seeing that in terms of our test scores. And the public and parents know that our education system is under stress and is not getting the help it needs. When we have a chaotic free market of education where vendors can sell whatever they want, this is in contrast to what other states do that we should do, which have tightly regulated, both in terms of transparency and their business side, which is another problem, but also quality control on new charters so that they do deliver a better education, and we're using them purposely to provide a better option where we need them. Where if we failed to turn around a school, let's replace it with a good charter. But let's not let any and all people open up new schools and deliver mediocre or poor education. We can't afford it, and it's hurting our outcomes of learning for all our students.
Assuming you're right, who needs to step up here? The legislature, the Michigan Department of Education, the State Board of Education? Who is it most incumbent on to begin to address this, assuming you are correct?
All of us. We've been and we will be calling for specific legislation from the legislature. We need legislation that both clarifies and makes clear regulations on kind of the policing of charters as a business. Full transparency, can't hide behind you're a for-profit operator, not show your books. We need to make it clear when they're self-dealing and other things, who can shut them down and enforce that. But we also need clear quality control and quality expectations for new charter schools. That was a complete failure or rejection. Our recommendations 2 years ago when the cap was lifted, the university cap on charter schools and the cyber cap, the state board said, if we're going to lift the cap, at least let's have common sense. New schools should not be run by people that have a bad track record of educating kids already. We can't afford to waste taxpayer dollars. We can't afford to have more kids not learning, and it hurts the kids that are left in traditional schools with diminished services. The legislature rejected those recommendations, and the governor went along with them. So we need quality control, new quality control. We should have a moratorium on any new school creation starting now until we have quality charter. Massachusetts, you know, Paul Revelle was just in, I think he was on your show, the commissioner of Massachusetts.
He was.
They have the best education system in the state. They treat charters differently, and we should too. We do not need any and all new charters, particularly ones that are mediocre or poor. We need charters that are innovative and very high quality only, as in addition, that improves education outcomes, not diminishing them. So we should treat charters differently.
Dan Quisenberry of MAPSA, the Michigan Association of Public School Academies, told Tim Skubick on Off the Record late last week that Michigan charters actually have more oversight than conventional public schools.
I think the Free Press series makes that very clear that they certainly have not. The authorizers, the public bodies that could be and should be, do it very indifferently. Some do look hard and police hard their charters. Others totally turn a blind eye, or you would not be seeing these incredible stories of self-dealing, rejection of the actual charter board that was assembled, recommendations for we want to do something different with our leases in favor of the management companies. So we have wildly different behavior among the authorizers. Some are hands-off, anything goes, money-making out the wazoo, and some care deeply and have been willing to shut down bad schools and police them. But that we can't afford to have good, bad, and ugly when it comes to charter schools. It's costing us too much money. It's hurting educational outcomes. We need good charters, of which there are many, and I'm pro-charter, and we need charters as a purposeful strategy for how we create a new, better option where we need it, or how we create in the context of school communities wanting to do something innovative and do it better.
Michigan school kids will be taking the MEEP test for for another year. What is your take on the return to the MEEP test for another year after so much anticipation of the Smarter Balanced Assessment?
I'm delighted that we are going to continue to be a state that's leading in implementing and putting in place good, rigorous learning standards that are what the state chooses to do, the Common Core, along with other standards and other disciplines that are high and rigorous. And we're going to develop an assessment per the legislation that assesses those standards.
It's just going to take longer than you would have liked.
Well, I think we're on our way. The key was getting the continued march forward to have good rigorous learning standards that prepare people well, and we'll get the assessment in place that does evaluate those standards so that we know whether kids are learning. And that's what I believe this legislation will allow us to do, and that's good. And we'll go on to try to do other things, like reform the way we organize and fund schools so that we can provide more help and support. We've laid out very rigorous learning expectations and teacher evaluation expectations. We've got to get in the state on with the business of providing better help, better support, better investment in education, or we'll never support our educators in helping deliver those high standards, which we definitely want to see happen.
John Austin heads the Michigan Economic Center at the Prima Civitas Foundation. John is also president of the State Board of Education and a non-resident senior fellow with the Brookings Institution. Great to see you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
Coming up on Current State, Cooley Law School Professor Devin Schindler will help us understand yesterday's Supreme Court ruling involving Hobby Lobby. It's Current State on WKAR. Dr. Charles Hyde is a former Wayne State University professor and the author of the 2014 book Images from the Arsenal of Democracy. The photo documentary follows the wartime transformation of the Detroit auto industry into the war machine of the late 1930s and early 1940s. WKAR's Peter Worf spoke with Dr. Hyde by phone recently. Hyde began the conversation by talking about planes and their power plants.
I mean, if there was one thing the auto companies were set up to do, although these engines were different from what they were used to, was to make engines in large quantities. You know, they had no experience with making aircraft wings or tails or fuselage sections or anything like that. They kind of had to learn that on the fly, but they at least had some knowledge about engines, so they were a natural choice. The other reason the auto industry became so important, and this really was by design from Bill Knutson and others, is that they had experience in mass-producing complicated products using interchangeable parts. And if you were going to ramp up aircraft production, you had to get away from this sort of handicraft system that the aircraft companies use to mass production techniques. And the auto industry, because of all their experiences, you know, starting with Henry Ford and the Model T, they were well set up to, design and produce blueprints and then produce the machinery needed to mass produce these materials. And, you know, it's amazing. At its height, the Willow Run plant, which made B-24 Liberator bombers out in Ypsilanti, they were producing a bomber an hour.
Yeah.
On an assembly line. It was like cars, except planes are bigger and more complicated.
And this was Willow Run's product, a giant flying machine for which the plant was so carefully tooled that it could produce one every 55 minutes. This is the Army Air Force's Liberator heavy bomber.
Yeah, it's interesting that you point out before the war, planes were more of a handmade, handcrafted item, and the transformation comes when you have to churn out thousands of them in a week's time.
Well, and when you've got parts coming from as many as 10 or 15 suppliers, at that point, the blueprints have to work. They have to be accurate, and they have to be consistent. Otherwise, you end up with a bunch of parts that don't fit.
Dr. Hyde, speaking of blueprints, I thought an image that made quite an impression on me from the 2014 images from the Arsenal of Democracy was one of many, many men in a huge room working on blueprints, almost as far as you can see, guys sort of moving around the room, guys up on top of tables working on these blueprints.
Yeah, that was the practice called lofting, which actually came from the shipbuilding industry. When ships were designed, they actually would build full-size blueprints showing all the different curves and parts of the ship. And this practice transferred over to the aircraft industry. And in fact, those bombers were referred to as ships, not as airplanes, because a lot of the design methods were the same. And what you see in that one image was very large sections of the fuselage at full size on those big tables.
Here's a story that you told about something that you learned about extensive testing at the Dodge Chicago plant, where engines were built at this 3.5 million square foot facility. And there is a very impressive story about building and taking apart engines. Can you recall that?
Yes. Aircraft engines were subject to a testing protocol or methodology that was really unlike anything you saw in the automobile industry. You know, the automobile industry did design engines and then would run tests on those engines, but they would typically test a few of them in the early stages and of the design process to make sure they were acting like they were supposed to. But once they went into production of, say, a V8 engine, they might pull one out of every 100 off the assembly line to run some tests to make sure it was still up to standard. But when we get to aircraft engines, they extensively tested every single engine, normally for 4 hours on a test stand at these factories. But the remarkable thing is they would then let the engine cool off and take it apart into all of its thousands of pieces.
Right.
And they would lay those pieces out on benches. And first of all, they would visually examine every single piece for things like cracks or wear or, you know, other defects, signs of stress. A lot of the parts were then also x-rayed to make sure there was no stress or damage to the parts. And when there were parts that were defective, they would replace them with new ones and then run the engine for another 4 hours before finally shipping it out to go into an airplane. The interesting thing about that process, as I discovered in looking at some of the detailed records of some of the plants, is that more than half of the inspectors were women who inspected these parts that, you know, these disassembled aircraft engines. It's a very interesting phenomenon that really surprised me. I had no idea. A lot of these aircraft plants, almost all the women that were employed were inspectors. That's what they did.
Dr. Charles Hyde is the author of Images from the Arsenal of Democracy. That's a 2014 publication by Wayne State University Press, also the author of Arsenal of Democracy, the American Automobile Industry in World War II, also from Wayne State University Press, and the author of many other books. He was a professor at Wayne State University. Speaking of women working in the arms industry in World War II, in Images from the Arsenal of Democracy, the most recent release, you point out what you said was a very rare photo, African-American women working on the line assembling, I think it was 50 caliber machine guns in Evansville, Indiana. It was
right.
Rare to see these images.
Yeah, those were 50 caliber cartridges.
Okay.
for guns.
Right.
They were packing them into boxes. Yeah, African-American women were the last new group of workers hired in the course of the war. They faced particular serious kinds of discrimination that even black men didn't face. Now, admittedly, black men had a lot of opposition from white workers when they first started coming into the plants, but black women, hiring black women was opposed not only by white men, but most vehemently by white women who were already in the plants.
Hmm. Another group of people that I learned about, I thought was very interesting, was workers who were little people that would do things like go inside of aircraft wings to work in those places and other very tight areas. And there's a photo of little people who were aircraft workers meeting with the famed aviator and World War I ace Eddie Rickenbacker.
Yeah, at the Willow Run plant.
Right.
Many of them had previously worked in circuses as performers.
Right.
But when the war started, the government basically shut down all the circuses. The circuses went out of business for the duration of the war. The government could not make either trucks or railroad cars available for circuses to go around the country. And so
right.
The circuses basically went out of business. Well, all these workers then had to find something else to do. And these little people were ideally suited to work in these plants because they could get into these very tight places, and so they were hired. I think at one point at the Willow Run plant, Ford had something like 20 or 25 of these little people working there.
So then after the war, what was that transition like for automakers going from war production back to automobile production?
It was difficult, to say the least. The government began flat-out canceling a lot of their war contracts by February or March of 1945, even though the war was still going on. They knew the end of the war in Europe was pretty inevitable. They didn't know quite how quickly it would happen. And that meant that those workers, at least temporarily, were thrown out of work. And there was, during the rest of 1945, quite a bit of unemployment as the auto industry tried to convert back to civilian automobile production. It really wasn't until late 1946 and into 1947 that the auto industry really got back to close to full production of automobiles. It was a very difficult transition.
Dr. Charles Hyde is the author of the 2014 book Images from the Arsenal of Democracy. That's from Wayne State University Press, a companion book to Arsenal of Democracy, the American Automobile Industry in World War II, also from Wayne State University Press. Dr. Hyde, thanks very much.
Okay, you're very welcome.
For Current State, this is Peter Ward.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Just a quick reminder that in the coming months leading up to the elections later this year, that WKAR and other stations on the Michigan Public Radio Network will be hosting interviews with the gubernatorial and Senate candidates here from the state of Michigan. We get started a week from Friday with Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mark Schauer, who will be here in Studio S and be interviewed by the Michigan Public Radio Network's Rick Pluta. We'll be taking your phone calls, and that happens in lieu of Current State on Friday, July 11th, here, 9 a.m. on WKAR. The Supreme Court of the United States yesterday ruled that the craft company Hobby Lobby can be exempted from paying for certain types of employee birth control. There's been a ton of comment on the ruling. For our own analysis here on Current State, we bring in Devin Schindler. Professor Schindler teaches constitutional law and healthcare regulation at Cooley Law School. Welcome and thanks for joining us.
Well, my pleasure to be here on an exciting week in the history of the Supreme Court.
That's right. Could you briefly recap what was in front of the High Court yesterday?
Well, the Hobby Lobby case is a fascinating case, but maybe not for the reasons many people think. The first point I want to make about Hobby Lobby is that it was a decision about statutes, not a constitutional decision. Essentially, in Hobby Lobby, we have two statutes that conflict with one another. The Affordable Care Act requires employers that provide health care coverage to include certain forms of birth control, including four medications that are designed to terminate pregnancy after the ovulation has occurred, as well as other kinds of birth control. Three companies, including the Hobby Lobby company, are closely held businesses. In other words, they're only owned by one or two or three people, as opposed to General Motors, which is a publicly traded company. The owners of these three companies, including Hobby Lobby, have strong religious and sincere religious beliefs against any kind of medication or procedure that would terminate a pregnancy after ovulation. And so on one hand, the Affordable Care Act required them to provide insurance coverage, including these four medications with which they had a strong religious disagreement with. On the other hand, there is a law known as RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, passed by Congress a few years ago, that essentially says any federal law that substantially burdens one's religious beliefs or religious exercise can only be justified and can be only upheld if the government has the most compelling of reasons to enact the law. And there is no other way for the government to achieve its compelling reason or compelling interest without interfering with the religious freedoms. So on one hand, one law says you must provide this form of birth control, which interferes with the owner's religious beliefs and religious freedoms. On the other hand, we have a law that says government cannot do so unless it has the most compelling of reasons. It's a classic case where I have two statutes that conflict with one another.
The ruling has triggered significant consternation on the left, significant satisfaction on the right. Can you help us understand why each side feels the way it does?
Well, it's an interesting debate because, you know, historically we think about the left, liberals, being strong proponents of individual rights and freedom from government interference. It makes kind of strange bedfellows because one way you can analyze this case is that, in fact, it increases our freedoms. It increases our rights because under the statute we have greater ability to exercise or freely exercise our religion without undue government interference. On the other hand, if the folks on the left can make the legitimate argument that, in fact, what this does is it takes away rights from women in particular. So it depends on which side of that coin you want to look to. If you look on one side of the coin, it's okay, the government has expanded through this RFRA law, has expanded our ability to freely exercise our religion. On the other hand, in this particular case, it does so in a fashion that may arguably interfere with the rights of women to obtain medical care, in particular birth control. From the conservative perspective, of course, it does expand your rights to freely exercise your religion and therefore fits well, in my mind at least, in sort of the agenda of the far right and the right in general to protect religion and protect people's ability to exercise their religions.
Professor Devin Schindler is our guest. He teaches constitutional law and healthcare regulation at Cooley Law School. We're talking about yesterday's Supreme Court decision involving the Hobby Lobby chain and others. You've read the ruling. What do you find most noteworthy about it? Is there anything that really jumps out at you in this ruling?
Well, the comment that I'm seeing an awful lot of in the media is sort of the notion that, oh my goodness, corporations have religious freedoms. I need to emphasize that, again, this is not a constitutional case. It's not about the First Amendment, a right to freely exercise your religion, but rather it's about a statute where Congress passed a statute saying that the government cannot substantially burden the exercise of religious rights. And so there's been a tremendous amount of back and forth in the media about, oh, my goodness, now corporations have religious rights. Well, the point the court made was twofold. First, Congress has yet another statute known as the Dictionary Act, passed this law called the Dictionary Act. And in the Dictionary Act, Congress said any time we use the word person or people in a statute, we mean living persons, and we mean corporations. So this case does not necessarily stand for the proposition that corporations have full First Amendment free exercise rights, but rather under the statute we are going to find the term persons to include corporations. And one point I'd like to highlight for folks, some of your anger for people that aren't happy about the decision might not be best directed at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court read the statute, read the law, and the law says when we use the term persons, we mean corporations. Congress can reverse this opinion because it's a statutory opinion by simply amending the law, amending the Affordable Care Act to say, or more importantly, RFRA to say, well, in RFRA, when we say persons, we mean living, breathing persons. And so this is not a case that says under a matter of constitutional law corporations have religious freedoms and religious rights, but rather under this particular statute.
Very interesting. The ruling applies only to what are referred to as closely held for-profit groups. And this, I'm led to believe, creates confusion for nonprofit groups like the Michigan Catholic Conference, which is also challenging the birth control mandate for religiously affiliated nonprofits. Can you help us understand this landscape?
Yes. In fact, the statute already has an exception for a religious exception for nonprofit religious groups. And the question becomes whether or not you qualify as a nonprofit religious group. And there's some case law, some cases going on that particular issue. But in general, one of the things the court had to struggle with is, on one hand, the law says, PPACA says, the Affordable Care Act says, well, this birth control mandate does not apply to nonprofit religious organizations. On the other hand, it does apply to for-profit organizations, no matter how sincerely held the owners or owners have religious beliefs, or no matter whether or not this profit corporation is involved in religion. For example, before this decision, if I had a for-profit company that gave millions of dollars every year to various charities, religious charities, I was in the business of selling Bibles and religious materials, I would not have an exemption, even though simply by changing my corporate structure, simply by saying, okay, instead of being a for-profit company, I'm going to be a nonprofit
right.
and take out all my money in a huge salary, suddenly by a simple stroke of the pen, I am no longer covered. And this distinction troubled the court, essentially saying, how can we truly distinguish between a nonprofit company that sells Bibles and religious materials and a for-profit company that does the same? The court found this to be an artificial distinction.
Could there be unintended consequences to yesterday's ruling?
What a great question. A lot of commentators, and I think there's some truth to this, see this as what I call a leverage decision. On its face, the ruling is pretty narrow. It only involves four medications that are covered under PPACA. The Hobby Lobby apparently has no problem providing coverage for birth control pills and condoms and things of that nature. It's just the medications that terminate pregnancies after a conception that they're the most concerned with. So on its face, it only applies to corporations, for-profit corporations that are A, closely held, 1, 2, 3 owners, 2, the owners have a sincere, strongly held religious beliefs, and there's some out there, but it's pretty uncommon, and 3, it only applies under PPACA. A number of commentators have said, well, this could be used to leverage and expand the ruling to cover publicly traded companies, all companies. This could be leveraged to areas other than birth control, like infusions. There are religious groups that oppose infusions. I've even seen arguments that, well, now perhaps the corporations that have strongly held beliefs, or should say their owners have strongly held beliefs about race, can now discriminate based on race. Well, the court was very careful and very clear in the last two pages of the opinion, saying, highlighting the fact that, look, this is a narrow opinion. The standard is government can still, under the statute, can still interfere or burden your free exercise of religion if it has a compelling reason to do so and no other way to achieve its goal. Well, by definition, the government has a compelling interest in preventing racism. And so a statute, our anti-discrimination statutes, in my mind, would not be subject to attack. I don't care how sincere your belief is about racism. The fact is the government has a compelling reason to prevent racism in our society, and so don't come to me claiming that you should be allowed to engage in racist activities. That's not what this case stood for. The same is true, say, of Christian Scientists that, generally speaking, have opposed lots of medical treatments. Well, does the government have a compelling reason to ensure that our citizens are provided with a wide gamut of medical treatments? And the answer is, of course they do. A healthy society, healthy America, that is an incredibly compelling reason. And so my guess is, and purely a guess, but if another company came along and said, we just opposed all medical treatments, we're not going to provide the coverage, the court would say, no, that's not what we meant in the Hobby Lobby case. It's a narrow opinion. The fear is that it opens the door to lots of these claims.
While we've got you on the phone, I'd like to ask you about one other Supreme Court ruling recently. They ruled regarding the EPA's authority to regulate greenhouse gases, and it, depending on who you ask, it either started to nibble away at their authority or it left their authority largely intact. What do you make of it?
Oh, boy, isn't this an interesting case?
We've got less than a minute, I'm sorry to say.
No worries. There's something in this case for everyone. On one hand, on its face, basically what happened is instead of being able to cover 86% of the companies out there that emit carbon dioxide, the EPA can only cover 83%. But once again, this is an issue that Congress can fix. This was a statutory case, and so if Congress were of a mind to provide the EPA with their jurisdiction or discretion to cover more companies or more types of greenhouse gases, they can do so. So there's something in this case for everybody. On its face, it's a very narrow ruling.
We want to thank our guest, Professor Devin Schindler, who teaches constitutional law and healthcare regulation at Cooley Law School. Thanks for your time. We appreciate it.
A pleasure was all mine.
That is our show for today. Coming up Wednesday on Current State, we'll check out the Warhol on Vinyl exhibit at the Cranbrook Art Museum, which features Andy Warhol-designed album covers. We'll also talk prison reform with State Representative Joe Haveman. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Worf. The producer of Current State is Joe Lindstroth. Thanks to Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Lavery, also to Aaron Young for engineering and Nicole Strobel for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.